We skip a couple of the verses describing the present that Jacob sends to his brother. It's a lot of goats, a lot of ewes, a lot of camels, a lot of cows, and a lot of donkeys. Leave it at that. Now that same night, Jacob gets up and takes his two wives, his two maids, and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and likewise everything that he had. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Then the man said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." Then the man said, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And then he blessed him. So God called the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." Friends, this is the word of the Lord. We sometimes forget, we talked about this in Sunday school this morning, that the book of Genesis is really just about four generations of a family. After we get through the very beginning, and Noah's Ark, and things settle down with Abraham and Sarah, then it goes to Isaac, and then it goes to Jacob, and then it goes to Joseph. Okay, so it's really just four generations of a family story. And so this summer we talked about Jacob when he was leaving on this trip. He had just conned his father, Isaac, out of his brother Esau's birthright and blessing, and was essentially running away before his brother could wring his neck. Esau is the manly man of the two brothers. He's the one who works out in the fields and with the livestock. He smells like sweat and domesticated animals. That's, you know, why Jacob's mother has him wear animal hide to convince his dad that he's his brother. I mean, it's all in the story. And when Jacob leaves, he leaves still as mom's favorite. He leaves with his brother in hot pursuit, and he stops for the night, and he has a vision of angels going up and down a ladder, and his prayer then is highly contingent. His prayer is, "Hey God, if, then maybe I'll sort of believe in you." Now, many of you were raised in church. I want you to imagine, if you will, for a moment, what it must be like to be the younger son, not by much, of a man who is literally a gift from God. That's the story, isn't it? And we forget that literally, Isaac is a gift from God. You thought you had a lot to live up to. When they talk about Father Abraham, they're talking about Grandpa. This story is very close and it's very dense. And so Jacob is really kind of like a sleazy divorce lawyer who has a job on the side as a used car salesman who also is selling timeshares. (Laughter) And it really makes you wonder, where did the genetics come from? But he goes off, and a lot of things happen. He is gone for 20 years. He's gone for 7 years to marry Rachel. Oh, I forgot that, right? He's gone for 7 years to marry Leah, which he thought was 7 years to marry Rachel. And then another 7 years to marry Rachel. And then another 6 years to work for his father-in-law's flocks. He's been gone for 20 years. He has somewhat matured. So he has had the tables flipped on the trickster for the first time. The way the biblical narrative of this goes is it's hilarious. They have this wedding scene, and they go into the wedding tent, and they do what you normally do on the first night of a married life. And the verse in the Bible is, "And he awoke and looked at his bride," period. "And it was Leah," period. Whoops. And then Laban says, "Oh, that's not how we do it around here. You got to marry the older one to get the younger one." And another 7 years pass. And Jacob starts early Mendelian genetics and breeds his flock true and strong, which Laban's sons don't like because Laban's sons are now going to inherit the lousy flock. And so they run him out of town. And eventually we're coming back here. That's the story in a nutshell so far. Now, the biblical account focuses on the Jacob side of the story. The Esau side of the story that I'd like you to consider is this. For 20 years, you have been at home, deprived of your inheritance, deprived of your blessing, with your mother, who did literally always love him best. So if you want to know why Esau might still want to kill Jacob, I give you Family Dynamics 101. Jacob's prayer this time sounds very different than last time. He has sent people on ahead to greet Esau and sent some gifts, and the message has come back, "Oh, Esau's there, and he's got 400 of his best friends to meet you." Anybody else think this doesn't sound like a good time? So Jacob cuts things in half. He sends his family on ahead. He saves part of the flock, and he thinks that maybe this way, if Esau kills people, he'll only kill half the people. And then he prays, "God, I'm kind of a lousy excuse for a human being. I don't deserve what you've given me." As we talked about in Sunday school this morning, a lot of times there is a sense in Christianity that there is no understanding of grace in Judaism, but this prayer would give the lie to that. "I don't deserve what you have done for me, and I thank you for doing it anyway. When I left here, I basically had the staff in my hand and the clothes on my back, and now I have enough stuff that I can split it into two separate camps. And I am terrified of my brother. I cannot imagine Jacob being terrified of Esau 20 years earlier. Earlier, it just seems like he's the one playing the jokes on the big dumb jock. And he seems content to do that. And now he has realized things have come around." And then we get to the famous part of the passage where a man shows up when Jacob is all alone and they wrestle all night, and neither one of them prevails. And finally, the stranger, the visitor, says, "Let me go. It's time." And Jacob says, in tenacious little Jacob underdog, gets his name by holding on to his brother's heel as he's coming out of the birth canal. That Jacob says, "I'm not letting you go until I get something from this." That's the Jacob we know and love. He says, what do you want? I want a blessing. It's kind of a vague, amorphous thing to ask for, isn't it? How many of you put blessing on your Christmas list? How many of you have blessing on your shopping list? Right? It's kind of, okay, what are you going to do with this? The stranger says, I'll give you a new name. You'll be Israel, one who has struggled with God and with humans and prevailed. Then the stranger cheats, essentially breaks Jacob's hip, and gets out of there. The passage continues that Jacob named the place Peniel because here he had seen God face to face, and then he limps on across the river the next day. This story, when we're willing to expand it to the backstory and not just make it kind of the cutesy version of Footprints from the Bible, not just that there's a man and God and there, I mean, the theology of that is really bad, that Jacob, con man, shyster, is able to out-wrestle God. I don't know, I feel kind of like this is somebody letting their six-year-old win. We get here in a way that's significant only if we tell the whole story, though. We can't just do this in 10 or 12 verses or a chapter. And so Jacob is humbled before he even prays. Now, before he goes on this 20-year journey, Jacob does not know the meaning of the word humble. It's not even in Jacob's vocabulary. But he comes humbled, and the next day, he is going to limp across the river to meet his brother. If you have ever had to limp into a room, you know that dignity is just out the door. You look weak. You feel lousy. Jacob's not entering this conversation on a high level of power. But he is finally doing it faithfully. He has finally admitted that he is a good for nothing. He has struggled mightily, and I don't just mean on that one night. Over 20 years, he has struggled. He has been the outsider in Laban's family. He has been taken advantage of by Laban on numerous occasions. In the longer speech at the end of chapter 31, when Jacob is defending himself to Laban's sons, he says, "Your dad changed the terms of my employment 10 times in the last 6 years. I don't want to hear it from you people about what fair is," which sounds really funny coming from Jacob's mouth. He is coming back to Esau. He is coming back home 20 years older. Two wives, two maids, 11 children. Tell me that doesn't change a man. Limping. We often encapsulate this story as just Jacob and make it happen really fast. This story doesn't happen really fast. It's 20 years. What have you been struggling with God with for 20 years? What has God needed to break your pride about? You notice that there's a little bit of pride still left in Jacob that he sends everybody on and, nope, it's just me. I can handle this on my own. And then the stranger shows up and plans go awry. This story is not an immediate, immaculate, powerful conversion story, immediate development of faith. Jacob gets what most of us want. He sees God twice. And the first time, he's not sure it's really God. Well, if that was really you. And the second time, he's terrified. And he crosses the river, and when he sees Esau, it's amazing because there's a conversation between Jacob and Esau that reveals that the original Jacob hasn't quite left the building yet. Jacob says to his brother, "I see the face of God in you, because you didn't kill me. Only because of that." Now, what is it that we struggle with for decades? Yes, a lot of us struggle for decades with the family we grew up with. I don't think I'm talking out of school to say that. We struggle with the things we did wrong when we were younger that have not left us completely. We struggle with the if of faith. I mean, seriously, I know that you guys were raised in church, but you were not raised with a father who is a gift of God. If you can sit there and grow up in that household and still wonder if there's a God, and if that God is interested in human beings, you have clearly not been paying attention. Or you really, really don't want to believe that God takes an interest in human beings and changes the course of our lives. Jacob spends his 20 years, and he learns some things. He learns he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And he learns that if you live by conning people, people will feel your fair game as well. He learns that it being your mother's family is no guarantee they're going to be nice to you. Just like your brother being your family was no guarantee that you were nice to him. And he changes how he prays from an if to a would you and a will you, with a recognition of everything that God has already done. I think that's a journey that many of us undergo over 20 plus years of faith. Go from a God that we'll sort of believe if God will do what we want God to do. God, if you'll give me a pony for my birthday. God, if you'll heal my friend, my parent, my sibling, my spouse, my child, my loved one, then I will. God, if this is the winning Powerball ticket, then you know how I'll spend it. You can have 10% of that $600 million, God. No problem. That changes to a God, you have been with me through all these things. You have been with me, you have been good to me, and now I'm going into something that terrifies me, and I just want you to be with me. That is a different kind of prayer because it comes out of a different kind of faith. At some point, Jacob's faith has changed. It's hard to know exactly when. We don't have a prayer journal. We don't have the sense that he read my utmost for his highest every day and suddenly he saw the light. We don't have any of that stuff about Jacob's personal faith life. We have two prayers, 20 years apart, that do not sound the same. And we have a large part of the story of what happened in that 20 years. I think most of us recognize that Esau would be right to wring his little brother's neck. And as satisfying a story as that may be, that's not what happens. Jacob doesn't get what's coming to him, which frankly is the good news of the entire gospel, is that we don't get what's coming to us. The question I would ask you today is, what have you struggled with for years? And how have your prayers changed? If you left to go to see Uncle Laban one way, how do you come back home? What is the difference that has happened over two decades, two wives, two handmaidens, and 11 children in your life? What has been your long struggle with God that has perhaps left you limping, but that also has sent you on to cross the Jordan? To God alone be the glory this day and forevermore. Amen.